Good evening, everyone. So what we're going to do tonight is I'm going to talk just a little bit, and then I'm hoping we'll have a conversation, and then Tenny will talk a little bit at some point, and then we can continue the conversation. So it's kind of maybe call and response. One of the many things I loved about our koan salon last night was how many versions of the Qian story there are, how many interpretations, how many ways that it goes, you know, so many beautiful versions. And a reading of it that feels true to me, and I think perhaps to some others, is that it's a story about healing, about healing parts, healing the self, healing parts of the self that have been kind of split off or cast asunder that can be reunited. And you know, I was thinking about, you know, Joan would talk about reuniting the token, you know, the two pieces that have, you know, travel in different directions, and then they can come together and form the whole again. And, you know, also, you know, how much of the Vimalakirti story is about that reconciling of dualities or opposites, which is really about coming back together. And there is a feeling of healing in that. It's not something, a word that we use a lot in Zen. Of course, it also brings up the Paula Arai book on women's domestic Zen, and women in Japan who really experience their personal Zen practice as a practice of healing, which I think is just really lovely and kind of touching and real and intimate and useful. So, you know, as I've been pursuing in this retreat, I'm really interested in this question of how we can bring Dharma practice and koan inquiry to our own internal life and our own experience of healing, whatever that might be for us. And part of what healing is reclaiming what's been exiled. And sometimes that can be those just young, you know, hurt parts of ourselves that we just want to kind of forget about and move beyond. Although, you know, they kind of end up returning in sometimes in destructive ways. And to really welcome and thank our survival strategies, like all that planning, you know, that you do sometimes on the cushion, or problem solving, or defending yourself from the imaginary attackers. You know, it's all just stuff we learn to survive. And we can heal these divisions. But it doesn't mean that they go away or that things are perfect, but we just heal by accepting the divisions and mourning. And for some of us, the healing that needs to be done can also feel maybe like it's not completely personal. Sometimes we have family, like transgenerational healing. We have a feeling of receiving a burden from our ancestors. Maybe our parents or grandparents, maybe our tribe, maybe even our culture, you know. We all, you know, receive pain and suffering, you know, from that just gets handed down and isn't necessarily our personal experience. So that's another kind of healing that we can gather into our meditation practice. And I have been feeling how present that is here, and how intimate it feels to be doing this together and to be sharing it together. It feels just real, you know? Like this isn't escapist Zen. You know, this is real practice, real life. And we start by just becoming intimate with our actual experience. We notice how much we can, I know I've done it plenty, we can use meditation to flee. And so can we really actually be with our actual experience, which might be a physical sensation, often like a contraction is a place that we can feel into, maybe a place of pain, or energy that's moving. And we can find perhaps some emotion there and just really feel it, like let yourself just really feel it and go into it. And if it feels warded off or inaccessible, a lot of times it's held in the body, you know? We hold a lot in our bodies. And so we can go all the way inside of that, and that is a place of practice. It can be a beautiful gate to practice, when we can bring patience and kindness and inquiry and spaciousness and bring our practice there. Last night I started to talk about this feeling that we're weaving and unweaving, you know, in our stories, in the Qian story, in our stories, in our practice. Something comes together, and then we can let it soften and kind of loosen and fall apart a little. And, you know, the beloved archetype for this, of course, is Penelope. At her loom, she would weave all day and unweave all night, and that was her practice. You know, maybe it's all of our practice. And in our sutra service, one of our readings, taking part in the gathering, it says, we and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. So sometimes our practice is this weaving and unweaving. And Joan used to talk about shimmer, you know, this quality of like the aspen leaves, you know, how they shimmer in and out. And you kind of can't tell which is which. And so we do this kind of shimmer between healing, reconciling, weaving, and a kind of expanding and unweaving, a decentering and enlarging. And we do both, you know. Sometimes it feels like it's alternating, and sometimes it feels like both at exactly the same time. And we're doing this work, this healing, this weaving, and the letting go, the unweaving, on behalf of ourselves and on behalf of our families and our loved ones and our ancestors, and also because when we do this work, it puts us in the best possible position to go forth. You know, go forth in the world and be a part of the healing of the world. The world needs healing, and we could really engage in that when we know what healing feels like from the inside and how to be the medicine. And that's another reason why it's important to to find the healing, the reconciliation that Qian found, at least in this version of the story, you know, in our own practice. So I'd love to hear what's on your minds.
So we're not going to record the conversation.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's right. Thanks. Yeah, we're not recording the conversation, just the talks.
Jump out first. Yeah, that'd be great. So I'll pretend for a second to blame everything that I'm going to say on Ellen. Because what they always say, so in the leaders meeting this morning, we had the usual talk, which is the retreat's going to be over tomorrow, but we don't want to think too much about that ourselves, but there's some logistical things we have to do, but we really don't want to get everybody else involved in logistics because it's really important not to have people leaving the retreat, you know, before, you know, stay in retreat as long as the retreat's going. So in a way that, you know, it's a don't mention the end of the retreat. But since Ellen said, oh, the retreat is like weaving and unweaving, the whole talk is going to be about endings of retreats and things like that, right? And maybe a way to kind of think about this is probably easier. Right? So Joan used to say that about coming to retreat, it was like this perfect world swirls into existence. Yeah. And then it swirls out of existence, and it's gone. And again, by pointing that out, I don't want to say, you know, get ready, it's over, but I want to think about endings in a kind of different way. So one of the things to say about that perfect world of the retreat is it's a kind of ritual or magical space, as if kind of swirled into existence by a conjuring trick. And it also seems true, usually, that the space of a retreat or any ritual space has this kind of both-and quality, you know, things seem very real in retreat and also kind of dreamlike. It seems like something, you know, form is very definite, either in, you know, Martha's sense of womp, there it is, or all the things that we're working with from our particular pasts. And there's also a sense of something vast that holds all of it and so on. And so to use that word shimmer in a different context, there's that feeling of a kind of shimmer in the retreat, and that has something to do with the sort of ritual space. So one of the things that we notice maybe is it takes us a while for that ritual space to really kind of come into being, or it's there, but we're not there. Another thing we might notice, this used to happen to me a lot, is the day before retreat, I would feel like I was already in retreat. You know, so it's got this kind of fuzzy boundary. The retreat is already sort of calling you. And I think in a similar way that the ending of retreat is not, you know, here it is and there it's not, but it's a kind of fuzzy zone or a process, and I think it's got its own qualities and its own rituals, and so I want to try to talk a little bit about that. And I'm thinking partly of the last day rituals that we're going to be doing tomorrow, and maybe ways to think about that aside from a bunch of other stuff. I was thinking about it again today, and one of the things that struck me, maybe partly because it is, you know, it's a gradual, here we're doing the leaving thing, is it's got a really strange kind of both-and quality to it. So partly it's marking a boundary, you know, this is the retreat, that isn't the retreat, even though we're taking a little while to kind of cross that fuzzy boundary. But I think paradoxically, one of the things that it does is it gives us a feeling in some way that the ritual both ends the our rituals of ending both conclude the kind of magical ritual space and also give the sense of a kind of aftertaste or afterglow or afterlife of it that paradoxically lets it keep on kind of rolling. So the very things that are endings are also ways of extending or not ending. So just a couple of analogies in a way. A long time ago, I was teaching some Native American literature, though it's not my field, and I was teaching the Navajo night chant, which is an 8-day ceremonial that in many ways feels a lot like a retreat. And one of the things that's true is that there's the sand paintings are made as part of the ritual, and then the gods from the fourth world kind of come into this sand painting, which is this kind of magical ritual space. And at the end of the retreat, not the retreat, the ceremony, the 8-day ceremony, all those sand paintings are rubbed out. And I used to think about that as just, you know, they were here and now they're gone, but it's also kind of dispersing them, you know, let them go out and let them extend forever. In a somewhat similar way, there are ceremonial baskets in which things are placed during the retreat as part of the ceremony. And the last morning at the end of the ceremony, the people who are in charge of those come out of the indoor space where those baskets are and they shred them so they're unwoven. And again, you know, it's outside the space of the ritual, but it is a ritual. It's shredding the baskets so they don't exist anymore, but in a way it's sort of scattering them into the world. I was thinking also today, watching Martha walk the hall so beautifully, that that's got a similar quality to it. So probably if you're watching it, and maybe if you've done it, it really has this quality, you know, with the four corners and so on, of generating a kind of special, sacred, protected ritual space every day with the stick first down and then up. And then at the end of every day, we undo the hall, we undo the ritual space. But the amazing thing for me is, and I really felt it with Martha walking the hall, is right after she's done, I don't know quite how to say this, but it's got the kind of residue of it in a way. The space, you know, now it's not sacred, but it's got just those qualities. You can feel the kind of afterlife or the shimmer of it continuing onward. And my sense is that a lot of rituals of ending of ritual spaces are like that. So I'm going to dive into the Tempest a little bit, as I threatened to do a couple nights ago. I'll try to make it really brief. So one of the things that interests me about it is that one of the ways you can tell that there's this sort of fuzzy zone of both sort of ending and extending the ritual space so that we can take it out with us and carry it beyond the retreat. Let me intercede by saying one of the reasons I want to say this is that at least in my early years of sitting, I found the ends of retreats really painful and difficult, you know, kind of where did it go? And it wasn't as if all the kind of psychological stuff had disappeared, but somehow the very special ritual space that had swirled into being, it took a while to sort of feel that was also kind of rolling out into the world. Anyway, so one of the ways you can tell it's this kind of rolling, continuing and ending process at the same time is that in the play it keeps happening. It's like, oh, we did it once, we better do it again, we better do it a third time, right? So the first time, just I'll read it again because it's so gorgeous, and again sort of marking this, oh, now we're outside the ritual space but actually we're inside it. So Prospero the magician puts on this magic pageant for the wedding of his daughter and this guy, right, Prince Guy. And at the end of that, he's conjured up all these Roman gods and goddesses, and he says, oh, they were just pretending they're gonna dissolve, and so we're back in our real lives. But then he says, oh, but actually our real lives have that same dissolving quality. So we're kind of outside the ritual's ended, but the space that we're moved into still has that shimmer of just those ritual qualities. And again, partly that's that both and thing, you know, is it empty, is it form, is it real, is it a dream? Okay, so our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, thin air. And so that's the play. And then he says, okay, what about real life, right? And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherits shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. So I'm going to condense a lot of this stuff. But so a little bit after that, you know, he's dissolved the spell, but he's already sort of done the dream work that the magic ought to do. And he says, so let's get rid of all the magical apparatus. You know, let's move from the space of magic into just the real world. And so condensing and cutting here, he just says, I hear, but this rough magic I here abjure. I'll break my staff, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound, I'll drown my book. So he, you know, buries the staff of magic and drowns the magic book. And then my favorite, in a way, at the very end of the play, there's this odd thing where there's a little bit like the basket's being shredded. He kind of steps forward and he breaks what's called the fourth wall in the theater. So instead of being inside the ritual space of the play, he comes out and talks directly to the audience. So he's outside the ritual space. But he says, here I am, I'm Prospero. So he's still, you know, the actor pretending to be Prospero and carrying that forward. But then he says, there's more to it, but he says, you need to release me from this island that's been the fiction of the play, and release me to dissolve because I'm just a fiction, or release me to dissolve into real life, right? But again, there's that sense that you as the audience have to perform the magic that will dissolve the magic. You have to perform the ritual that will dissolve the play. And so one of the really beautiful things that's like the ending of the retreat is not only do the particular characters dissolve, but the whole experience of the play goes poof, you know, as if it never was. And that's part of the same kind of thing as the ritual of an ending of a retreat. And my sense again is that exactly as he says also all those things, and we kind of stand up and we're not in the play anymore, that the residue of that sort of magical shimmering space is preserved precisely by those rituals of ending, which are also rituals of extending and letting it keep rolling. And again, I'm skipping most of the lines here, so I'll make it quite short. But he says, now, so I've already given up my magic, right? So now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. I'm just a regular guy now. I don't have the magic anymore. And then he appeals to the audience. So he's sort of breaking out of the fiction, and he says, let me not dwell in this bare island by your spell, right? But release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. So you perform the magic that will undo the magic, right? And then as you from crime, so he's all worried about crimes because it's the Renaissance, you know, but as you from crimes would pardon be, let your indulgence set me free. So again, perform the ritual that will release me from the ritual. And as we get up from that, there's this odd kind of magical residue, as if that space can kind of keep rolling on forever, partly through the ritual act of ending it. So my sense in general is that Zen is full of such self-dissolving rituals. And so not a very spiritual one, but it's very quick and funny. Soen Roshi apparently used to say, Zen is like soap. You know, first you need the soap, you know, to clean yourself off, you need the Zen, but then you better wash all the soap off, you know, so the Zen dissolves itself. So there are lots of Zen koans and stories and rituals that in some way dissolve themselves. I mean, partly it's the ever-changing terminology that as soon as you want to say this is the metaphysics of Zen, it's going to dissolve on you. And it was in a way just a useful ritual space that's both real and dreamlike, right? And the tendency is that in the dissolving of those terminologies, or the dissolving of one koan dissolving itself, that somehow it rolls onward. So a really quick instance of that is this very beautiful thing that some of you may know, probably most of you know, two Master Ma koans from the Gateless Gate. So case 30 is Ancestor Ma's mind is Buddha. Dame asked Ancestor Ma, what is Buddha? Ancestor Ma said, this very heart mind is Buddha. And I mean, you could read that as metaphysics or doctrine, but in a way it's inviting you into this kind of ritual or dreamlike space where again, the real and the dreamlike shimmer into one another, you know? So what is this vast thing called Buddha or awakening? Just your very mind, right? But at the same time, what's your ordinary mind that annoys you all the time? It's already Buddha. It's already vast and empty, and those things shimmer in and out of one another. So, three cases further on, Ancestor Ma's no mind, no Buddha. A student asked Master Ma, what is Buddha? Ancestor Ma said, no mind, no Buddha. Right? So partly it contradicts the first koan, but also, right, you know, what's this Buddha that we're supposed to become? You know, forget about it, let it dissolve, right? What about this mind that we're supposed to pay attention to, the special Zen mind or preoccupation with checking our own minds? Mm-hmm. Just let it all dissolve. Mm-hmm. The feeling of working on that koan, at least for me, was a really strange kind of elation, because it both felt like the story of the koan had dissolved and I was just back in the real world, and it was kind of bare without stories and without magic. But it had that, still that sort of intensity of being so alive and also dreamlike, you know, that in the dissolving of the story, it was still there. And there's also something really beautiful, a little bit like the Soen Roshi, that in some way, you know, we need to tell ourselves the stories that Buddhism tells us. And then there's something really gorgeous about the way those stories just tend to dissolve, like that what happens in that koan. And there we are just back in our lives, but in some way they're changed. You know, there's this little residue of where we've been and what that space has been like. There's a story in there someplace where somebody says to Great Master Ma, or asks him, what do you tell a baby when it's crying, when it's all upset? He says, mind is Buddha. He says, what do you tell a baby when it's stopped crying? He says, no mind, no Buddha. You know? And I love that, because it's like the mind is Buddha is like this lullaby that we need in a way. Mm-hmm. And the no mind, no Buddha, it isn't brutal. You know, it's like now you're relaxed. You know, let's sort of let the lullaby sort of fade into its little after rhythm. You know, first there's mind is Buddha, then there's no mind, no Buddha. So my sense is that all the rituals tomorrow will have, you know, something of that quality. They're marking an ending. They're both inside and outside the retreat. And they're not just ways, I think, to sort of let us down gently and sort of feel better about the retreat ending, but they are this kind of magical undoing of magic, so that the ritual space that we've entered both dissolves and we walk back into our ordinary lives, and we're still walking in what I'm calling sort of the aftertaste or the after image or the residue of that ritual space. All right. So one other thing, all right? So the rituals will be the rituals tomorrow. I was trying to think of some pretend things that were sort of like rituals that we might ask ourselves or not, as we choose or not. And what I was going for was, well, what about this kind of space that's both inside and outside? And I thought, so the retreat is not ending. Don't listen to that, you know. But it's as if it were ending. And what if when we're here inside it, we imagined ourselves wanting to tell somebody outside it what it was like, not in a chit-chatty way, but in the deepest sense, or why it mattered. Maybe somebody that we're really intimate with, you know, so we can speak deeply to them, but somebody who's not a zenny, you know, so we're trying to really explain, here's what this world is. And I thought of just some questions, and they're maybe not the best ones, but so, how are the space and time around you here in the retreat and the space inside you slightly changed? How would you tell somebody else about that? And maybe imagining the telling now as a way of being both sort of inside and outside that space and letting it keep rolling. What does this space and this practice ask of us? What does it ask of you? What do you ask of it? What do you want from it in the deepest sense? How would you tell somebody else that? How's it really hard to do this practice, not just the painful body part, but again, in all the deep ways that Megan's been evoking for us, you know? What might this space heal in us, and how? What's most precious to you about this space of retreat and this practice? What do you hope to bring with you, carry with you across the threshold? And how might you feel now at least somewhat more capable of doing things that you didn't quite realize you could do, that can act in the world in a certain way, both for myself and for others? So those are just kind of hypotheticals, and they might lead to conversation or not. But again, my aim is to give us a sense of endings and of the rituals of endings that both shred the basket or dissolve the sand painting and let it scatter out into the world and be ours and everyone's. So thank you. But don't talk about endings.
Could you read those questions again?
Yeah. Can you turn these things off?